From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the conflict between the UN and the U.S. We talk with James Traub, author of the new book, The Best Intentions, Kofi Annan and the UN in the Era of American World Power. Also, we remember Richard Gilman, the drama and literary critic, died over the weekend at the age of 83. We'll listen back to a 1987 interview from our archive in which Gilman talked about his conversion from Judaism to Catholicism to atheism. He had just written his memoir, Faith, Sex, Mystery. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The UN Secretary General Kofi Annan steps down at the end of the year after serving two terms. My guest journalist James Traub has written a new book called The Best Intentions, Kofi Annan and the UN in the Era of American World Power. It looks at the UN under Annan's leadership, including the friction between the UN and the Bush administration, the failure to stop genocide in Sudan, and the controversy surrounding his son Kodjo's involvement in the oil for food scandal. James Traub has been a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine since 1998, which is also the year he first met Kofi Annan. In late 2003, Annan agreed to cooperate with Traub on a book about the UN and his place in it, and he agreed to let Traub sit in on meetings and travel with him. Traub interviewed him about 18 times. James Traub, welcome back to Fresh Air. Now, you said something very provocative about the UN in a book review that you wrote for Paul Kennedy's book about the UN. You wrote, "It takes a brave man or a blithe one to write about the UN as if it had some purpose other than either to obstruct or to accommodate American policy goals." So this is a double question. Question one is, are you brave or blithe? And question two is, why is it so difficult to write about the UN as if it had a purpose?
Well, I'm not going to attribute bravery to myself, so I'll just say I'm blithe. And I think the answer to the second part, which is the meatier part, is that I think opinions on the UN tend to get so deeply polarized. The UN does still have very much of a cheering section in this country and certainly elsewhere in the world, and maybe in part because it's so embattled, those folks tend to be just as single-minded as the folks on the other side. And so being critical can get you in some trouble, but obviously the bigger one is that right now there's such a kind of reflexive contempt for the UN, the idea that it's a soft place in a hard world, the idea that these folks are so averse to tough-minded solutions that they'll never choose one, the idea that they're trying to tie down the Gulliver, that is the United States. And so to speak at all well of the institution is to invite the idea that you are a kind of a sap because you've bought into all this sort of mushy, soft, idealistic stuff.
Do you think the Bush administration and the president himself started with a critical attitude toward the UN?
Oh, there's no question. I don't think, you know, the president in his initial meetings with Kofi Annan could not have been more polite, appropriate, gracious, you know, no, nothing abrasive, though I was told that Dick Cheney would sit in a corner with his head looking, you know, head down, looking at the ends of his wingtips, saying nothing. So there were clearly some people in the administration who thought the UN is nothing but an obstructive force. And I would say that the dominant mindset in the administration coming in, even before 9/11, was the Clinton administration allowed its policy to run through the UN to an excessive degree. They were far too enamored of the idea of international law and multilateral institutions. So they were determined to do what they thought was in the American interest. And if the UN was going to be helpful with that, fine. And if the UN wasn't going to be helpful with that, then we're just going to go ahead and do what we think is right. And you saw that before 9/11 in the relationship of the Bush administration to the treaties that had been passed in years prior, because well before 9/11, the administration renounced the Treaty of Rome, which established the International Criminal Court, renounced Kyoto, refused to really move any further with a series of treaties that had to do with small arms and nonproliferation and so forth. So, yes, certainly there was that deep skepticism, which in the case of some people amounted to active hostility.
But you point out that after September 11th, before the U.S. started bombing Afghanistan, the U.S. was pleased with the UN because it condemned the September 11th attacks, and the Security Council passed a resolution saying what?
Well, the Security Council passed a resolution which essentially said that the World Trade Center attacks constituted a threat to the United States such that, under the rules of the UN Charter, the U.S. would be justified at hitting back not only at the actual attackers, but at the country that gave them refuge, meaning Afghanistan. So that was actually a moment of very good feeling. The U.S. also reciprocated by immediately forwarding dues that were in arrears that it had owed, as well as immediately forwarding to the Senate the nomination for the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., which had been vacant at that time. So that was a brief moment of good feeling, and that really lasted, I would say, up until the late summer, early fall of 2002, when the debate over Iraq began.
But even before that, you say that after the bombing, when it came time to think about the rebuilding of Afghanistan, the United States and the UN were kind of coming at it at different angles. And the Bush administration had previously opposed the idea of nation building, and the UN was uncomfortable with the idea of neocolonialism, which, you know, the rebuilding of Afghanistan could be conceived of. So what was the relationship of the U.S. and the UN like in that period?
Well, I have to say, whatever the problems were, it looks terrific compared to Iraq. There was a point of convergence, I would say, between the U.S. aversion to nation building and the U.N. aversion to neocolonialism, and that was what was called the light footprint. Now, the light footprint is used in all sorts of ways, but what it was understood then to mean is that it would be clear that sovereignty rested with the Afghans themselves. And so all of the help that would be given would still fall underneath the umbrella of a sovereign Afghan government. I think where things failed was not that, but rather, all right, having granted this sovereignty and having avoided the neocolonial problem, how do you engage in this act, whether you want to call it nation building or something else, where you have a country that essentially hasn't really functioned as an effective sovereign nation ever, with unimaginably poor a country, certainly the poorest country, I think, outside of Africa, low level of development? I think there you did have a disagreement, not only between the U.S. and the U.N., but between the U.S. and many of its allies as to how big the development role should be and also how big the security role should be. And I think what we see now in Afghanistan is the consequences of the wrong part of the lightness of that footprint, which is too little money, too little focus on reconstruction, too little security outside Kabul. And the administration is really suffering the consequences of that now, as, of course, above all, are the Afghanis themselves.
My guest is James Traub, and we're talking about his new book, The Best Intentions, Kofi Annan and the UN in the Era of American World Power. Can you talk a little bit about how the Bush administration's push for regime change in Iraq looked from the Kofi Annan point of view, from the UN point of view?
Well, certainly from the Kofi Annan point of view, what I realized in the course of talking to him, and of course I should make clear that my conversations with him took place later than all this, starting in the middle of 2004, so this was a matter of retrospect. From his point of view, he thought the war was a big mistake. I mean, he believed that various forms of containment could continue working, and he does, in fact, did and does have a deep aversion to conflict unless he feels it is utterly unavoidable. But beyond that, or maybe even more important than that in his own mind, was the debate over the war cannot be allowed to destroy the UN and the Security Council. And so he was quite desperate to keep the council together. I was surprised to find that many people inside the institution who were clearly opposed to the idea of a war were nevertheless pleased and relieved when the Bush administration decided to seek a UN resolution authorizing war and to basically conduct its foreign policy through the Security Council, because they had gotten so worried that the U.S. had decided to dispense with the UN altogether that even the sort of ultimatum that President Bush issued when he came before the UN in September of 2002, they still thought, well, at least he feels he should be coming here.
So from Kofi Annan's point of view, was the UN undermined, and if so, how seriously, by the invasion of Iraq?
The answer is yes, and devastatingly. I think for him, the fact that this question of supreme importance came before the UN Security Council, and then after months of tremendously bitter and divisive debate, the council failed to come to an agreement. And then the U.S., with its allies, acted anyway. For him, this was a terrible outcome. And those who were around him then could see this very easily, because he went into a kind of shock. I mean, not I'm not sure exactly what the right way to characterize it is, though one of his own aides described it as a kind of a break. He lost his voice, which, of course, you can't help thinking about metaphorically. He didn't show up to work for several weeks. This was a little bit later. It was May of 2003, and clearly he was devastated by this. And the subsequent reform effort, which came to a kind of fruition in September of 2005, was really born out of Kofi Annan's sense that that the U.S. decision to engage in a preemptive war, in what he would have said and others would have said was a violation of the U.N. Charter, and to do so without the consent of the other nations in the Security Council, this posed a fundamental challenge to the institution, which had to be confronted not just by criticizing the U.S., but by seeking to change the institution in such a way that it could satisfy those concerns without merely becoming an appendage of U.S. foreign policy.
So Kofi Annan felt that the UN structure needed to be changed in the light of what happened?
Yeah. I mean, in the aftermath of the war in Iraq, Kofi Annan's first thought was, how can we remake the institution so that the United States will feel that it actually wants to use it? And what that meant was to create rules of engagement, which would essentially say that if you are facing a conflict situation and there's certain criteria that it satisfies, like there's no other way of solving the problem, there's an imminent threat and so forth, then you would have a right to go to war. So it began there and then increased over time to include a whole series of reforms, Security Council expansion, social and economic development, everything, until it became a kind of giant omnibus reform package.
And was any of that ever passed?
Some. I mean, it was hugely ambitious. And some parts of it were reforms that had been sitting around forever and had never succeeded and were never likely to succeed. The most famous example being making the Security Council more representative. That is to say, adding countries from the third world, like Brazil and India, as well as adding Germany and Japan, who were big donors to the UN. Well, that had been sitting around for 13 years, and the fact that it was part of this reform package didn't make it any likelier to pass. So that failed. Some others did succeed. Some little bits of management reform, the creation of what's called a peace-building commission, some small advances on terrorism, the creation of a new human rights council, which has proved to be a failure. So the answer is some stuff passed, but nothing like the initial hope.
My guest is journalist James Traub. We're talking about his new book, The Best Intentions, Kofi Annan and the UN in the Era of American World Power. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is James Traub, and we're talking about his new book, The Best Intentions, Kofi Annan and the UN in the Era of American World Power. So we've been talking about the big split between the UN and the U.S. when the U.S. invaded Iraq, and Kofi Annan still says he thinks it was illegal for the U.S. to do that. But the U.S. went back to the UN after the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. What did the U.S. need the UN to do? What did it ask the UN to do?
Well, all it wanted, but it was a big thing, was the good housekeeping seal of approval that comes when the Security Council accepts something, even in accepting it in retrospect. So essentially what they wanted was for the UN to bless the American occupation of Iraq. Now, the price for that was to give the UN some role in Iraq, but the U.S. didn't really want to give the UN much of a role. And so it succeeded to really 100%. It got this blessing by the Security Council. It gave the UN a role in which it said the UN will help and the UN will play an important role in this thing and that thing and this thing and that thing. But the UN didn't actually have any authority of its own.
And then the head of the mission from the UN to Iraq, Vieira de Mello, he had a 4-month commitment in Iraq. He was killed in an attack. Would you describe that attack that you describe as the worst disaster ever to befall UN civilians?
Yeah, it was a terrible disaster for lots of reasons, not the least of which being that this gentleman you mentioned, Sergio Vieira de Mello, was perhaps as much admired and as even loved as any official in the United Nations, but 21 other people died as well. This was in August, so they'd been there for several months, and they were staying in a place called the Canal Hotel. That was their headquarters. And the security was really lax in a way that I suppose is obvious in retrospect, but to some people was obvious then too. And a truck drove essentially beneath the office where Sergio de Mello was working and blew up. Causing the death of Vieira de Mello and 21 others. There had never been such an event in the history of the UN. It was devastating for the whole institution. It was devastating for Kofi Annan personally because he was deeply fond of Vieira de Mello. He had known him for many, many years, and he viewed him as a possible successor, as many other people did as well. More than that, he was blamed by people in the UN who were tremendously angry and embittered. Their real anger and bitterness was at the United States for having had the UN there in the first place. But they blamed Kofi Annan for being all too willing to accommodate the U.S. by sending a UN mission there, and they felt sending it there so quickly that there wasn't time for a sufficient security check, which was at least partly true.
So this attack happened in 2003. You say in your book that the UN's inviolable status was compromised in this event and it could never be restored. I mean, what did this event kind of symbolize to UN safety and UN neutrality?
Well, that there is no longer the idea of neutrality, the idea that the UN is protected by the fact that it doesn't represent the interests of any country, but represents this supreme interest of all men and all women. That clearly didn't provide any protection against the jihadists in Iraq. And increasingly, there have been attacks on UN peacekeeping forces and on UN civilian forces all around the world, but this was by far the worst. And so once you are no longer seen as sacrosanct in that way, well, you can't regain that kind of moral virginity. And so it meant that from now on, certainly in large parts of the world, the UN would feel endangered and would no longer have the ease of access and the ease of motion, which is essential if you want to play an important role in either political or economic or social development in any one of dozens of countries.
What role is the UN playing in Iraq now?
Modest, extremely modest. The UN has really quite a small role. There is a UN civilian force which deals with political issues and so on. But the hopes, once upon a time, the UN would have a much larger role have been scotched by the fact that the security situation is impossible. So the UN has an office in Baghdad and then several other cities, but it's very hard for them to get out. So really, the UN played a very important role in terms of the transition from the U.S. occupying force to the creation of an independent Iraqi government. Since that time, it's played a rather marginal role.
John Bolton is the U.S. ambassador to the UN, but he still has not been confirmed by the Senate because his appointment was so controversial. I mean, he was a known detractor of the UN. I mean, he when he was appointed, is it fair to say he didn't believe in the UN at all?
Well, let's say he didn't believe in it before he got appointed. What he would say is that if the UN is useful, we should use it. But the UN doesn't deserve any particular respect. This whole idea of that the UN has a kind of legitimacy the United States needs struck him as being preposterous, because he would say the United States carries its own legitimacy. And so he was always hostile to any kind of what he would have said was multilateralism for its own sake, as opposed to a purely pragmatic one. So his appointment was seen at the UN, as kind of sending Count Dracula to the institution. I mean, people recoiled in horror at the thought of Bolton.
Was Bolton's appointment seen by Kofi Annan as a provocative act?
Yeah, I think it was. He and I had a funny conversation months before it happened. We were in a plane in the middle of some swing through Africa, and I was asking him about his relations with the United States, and he was in a really dejected state. And he had just received what turned out to be the incorrect news that Bolton had been nominated. But, you know, when you're fearful of something, of course, you automatically believe it when you hear about it. And so he just said, what about the news of the new nominee? And he said this with a tone of the utmost dejection. And he took it as a way of the Bush administration basically sticking its thumb in the institution's eye. Well, it was premature, but in fact it did happen. It was something nobody was looking forward to. And almost as soon as Bolton came, he confirmed everyone's worst fears.
How?
By being unbelievably unyielding and quite indifferent to the difficulties he would put on anybody else by virtue of his unyieldingness. So he arrived in the middle of this a very heated debate about reform, trying to convince everybody to sign on to everybody else's concerns so as to produce some kind of package. And Bolton arrived, and literally the first day he arrived, he went to meet the president of the General Assembly. And he said, look, you've done a terrific job so far, but it's coming to an end because all the documents you're producing really aren't going to do any good. And we don't want to have all of these UN ambassadors that you've appointed getting in the way of our debate. So we're going to take the thing over and produce our own document. And thanks very much. Thus, in effect, throwing in the trash months worth of painstaking attempt to come to some kind of common agreement. And from that time forward, his behavior was so peremptory, so demanding, so undiplomatic, so unyielding that he made it that much more difficult to find a common ground, which was already terribly difficult in the first place.
James Traub is the author of the new book, The Best Intentions, Kofi Annan and the UN in the Era of American World Power. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from the Annenberg Fund for Excellence in Communications and Education, from the Mark G. and Bernie D. L. Strom Foundation for the NPR Fund for New Initiatives, helping to develop NPR's new programming and new media, and from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/fresh air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember Richard Gilman. The drama and literary critic died Saturday at the age of 83. We'll hear the 1987 interview I recorded with him after he published his memoir, Faith, Sex, Mystery. And we continue our conversation with journalist James Traub about Kofi Annan and the UN. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is journalist James Traub, author of the new book, The Best Intentions, Kofi Annan and the UN in the Era of American World Power. When we left off, we were talking about John Bolton, the U.S. ambassador to the UN, who has been antagonistic toward the UN and its mission. Has John Bolton made up with the UN? And I ask this because, say, sanctions against North Korea, for instance, John Bolton has worked with the UN on that. So, you know, and the Bush administration has worked with the UN on, you know, peacekeeping in Lebanon and working with the UN on sanctions against Iran. So are things improving in the relations now between the U.S. and the UN?
Yeah, Terry, I think especially if you put it not at the personal level, but at the level of foreign policy, then that is clearly true. I mean, the second term of the Bush administration feels very different from the first term of the Bush administration, and that's because in the first term, the Bush administration got whacked over the head by a 2x4. Everything they tried to do by themselves has turned out very badly. And so Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State, has clearly focused, as she said she would, on diplomacy, which includes the use of the UN. And so if you look, certainly, as you said, at the way the U.S. has conducted its policy on Iran, it has been extraordinarily patient with what is a very trying process of attempting to craft a Security Council resolution, including meaningful sanctions against Iran, unless Iran agrees to end its program of nuclear development. And that certainly has improved the atmosphere a lot. And these are the things in the end that are more important than, you know, whether or not John Bolton is abrasive in his personal behavior.
Now, you actually went with Kofi Annan to Sudan, where he hoped to persuade the government to call off the Janjaweed, which is the group responsible for the genocide. What can you tell us about observing him in action in Sudan?
Well, he is a diplomat to the last. I mean, it's nothing at all like watching most American diplomats who are very happy to wield the club that comes with American power. I mean, Kofi Annan has no club to wield. That's the nature of being Secretary General, but it is also his nature not to wield any clubs. And so when we went to Darfur, what I describe in the book is the whole entourage is whisked into a hot guest house where there's a whole party of Sudanese officials waiting for him. And so Kofi's goal here is to let them know that the world is watching and they can't get away with this systematic mistreatment of the people of Darfur, and that the UN believes and everyone believes that the government is in league with the Janjaweed to abuse the people of Darfur. Well, instead, he is subjected to a 45-minute monologue by a government official explaining why all these accusations are baseless. And he sits there quietly for the longest time, saying nothing, and then finally pipes up, and the government official says, "I'm not finished yet," and kind of runs roughshod over him. And then finally, Kofi says, "Well, I would like to ask you something." And he asks a rather mild question, and he gets a rather evasive answer. And rather than saying, "You guys are lying to me, and I know it," which he feels would be counterproductive because then they basically would give him the back of their hand, he tries to get them to reach agreement that indeed we must all stop this violence. And I left this thing feeling at the very best really ambivalent because it was obvious these guys were lying to him and they couldn't care less about the fine moral principles that he stood for. And he hadn't exactly instilled the fear of God in them. So, you know, if there was any hope that his visit was going to make a difference, it sure wasn't going to be in that.
I think the example you just gave us is a perfect example of what the UN is up against now in trying to stop genocides. How do you negotiate with people who obviously have, like, no conscience, no empathy, you know, no decency, or else they wouldn't be committing genocide in the first place?
Yeah, and not only that, how do you negotiate with them when you don't have a club to hold over their head?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not simply that it's naive to think that you can persuade monstrous people to behave in a non-monstrous way. That is naive, and I think one can accuse Kofi Annan of being optimistic to the point of naivete. But he also said to me then, and he says all the time, well, you know, yes, I should use a stick, but what stick do I have? And so if the Security Council is unwilling to pose a serious threat to these tyrannical figures, whether it's in Sudan or elsewhere, then when Kofi Annan goes to negotiate, he's got an empty hand. He can offer a carrot, but he can't offer a stick. And in fact, I would say that the underlying pattern of his diplomatic activity in Sudan was his attempt to use whatever carrots he had at his disposal, given that he had no sticks. Well, the fact is the Sudanese government wasn't going to respond to the offer of more trade and to be incorporated into the global economy and so on. They may have wanted that, but they didn't want that nearly as much as they wanted to have a free hand to deal with the rebels of Darfur and the people of Darfur as they wished. And so he wound up seeming quite helpless there, but I don't think a more tough-minded or firm or aggressive or whatever person could have made a bigger difference, because the underlying fact was he had no way of threatening them.
Well, that gets to another underlying problem you write about in your book, which is that a lot of countries blame the UN for being weak when it comes to, say, the Sudan. But at the same time, Kofi Annan can say the Security Council, the countries that sit on the Security Council, aren't giving the UN any power to do anything. So he points the finger right back at the countries.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the kind of ongoing argument between the UN and its critics, especially in the United States, which is the UN is weak, the UN is feckless, the UN is pacifist, and so on. Well, I actually, in the book, argue that, indeed, the UN's culture is some of those things, and the UN's culture is a real problem. But if you ask, why has there been no adequate response in Darfur? Why was there no adequate response years earlier in the most notorious cases, like the Balkans and Rwanda? The answer is not because the UN is weak and feckless, whether or not it is. The answer is because there was no political will on the part of the major countries, meaning the five countries of the Security Council. In the case of Darfur, we see that none of the countries really were eager to act. The United States was clearly the most aggressive, and it was sought to impose sanctions on the Sudanese regime, though there was never any thought of having anything like a humanitarian intervention, which is what everybody had pledged they would do in the case of massive violations of human rights. Both the Chinese and the Russians didn't want to have sanctions at all. They wanted nothing. And so between the lack of really deep resolve on the part of the three Western members of the Security Council and the genuine resistance on the part of China and Russia, nothing was done, and then little was done, and then a little more was done, but never was enough done.
I'd like you to give your assessment now of Kofi Annan's tenure as Secretary General of the UN, and he leaves at the end of this year.
Yes, Kofi Annan has served for 10 years, two terms, and his first term was incredibly successful. His second term, incredibly not. I don't think that's because he was a different person in the first term from the second. I think it's because the situation changed enormously. In the first term, there were several things he did that mattered a lot. One was when he arrived in 1997, the U.S. was really feeling that the U.N. was marginal. They had ousted his predecessor, Boutros-Ghali. The U.S. was falling way behind in the payment of dues. It was a very ugly time. And Annan himself, along with the U.S. ambassador at that time, Richard Holbrooke, did an extraordinary job of bringing the U.S. back into the U.N. That mattered a lot. He reanimated peacekeeping. Peacekeeping, which had been a marginal enterprise, became a much bigger enterprise. He made the UN, in that sense, a more active operational body. Also, at the rhetorical level, he spoke up for humanitarian values in a way that previous secretaries general had not. He spoke about the UN as a place that would defend the rights of individuals, not merely the states who were members of it. Indeed, defend the rights of individuals against those states at times. He championed the idea of humanitarian intervention, which meant that you would be willing to violate the sovereignty of a member to save the people of that country from tyrannical, from abusive treatment. So for all those reasons, he won, and I would say deserved, the Nobel Peace Prize in 2001. Second term couldn't have been more different. Why? Iraq and the Bush administration. So he was then put under, the UN was then put under a kind of tension which it could not easily survive. The Bush administration wanted various goals that the institution would not grant. They could not find agreement to go to Iraq. And that was only one of many different disagreements. So certainly I would say from late 2002 through the end of 2004, the institution was paralyzed. Kofi Annan was deeply damaged. The oil for food scandal made it all the worse. Now, I would say the last year or two has proved to be better, I think because of a change in the Bush administration, a greater willingness to use diplomacy. And Annan is widely admired for the role he played in bringing a settlement, if a temporary one, to the Israel-Lebanon war that we recently had.
Kofi Annan's successor is South Korea's foreign minister. What do you know about him, and what kind of UN Secretary General he's likely to make?
My guess is that he was chosen because, as John Bolton likes to put it, he would be more secretary than general. I think both the U.S. and China wanted somebody who would be an administrator, who would take care of business, who maybe would do some good management reform, but who would not try to push around or eclipse the major countries through diplomatic pronouncements or kind of moral adventures. My fear is that in Ban Ki-moon they got just that person. Yes, the UN desperately needs management reform, but a secretary general who chooses to behave like a kind of private figure and mostly tends to the institution itself and doesn't use the that public rostrum that he has, I think is going to fail to do something terribly essential for that institution.
James Traub, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
James Traub is the author of the new book, The Best Intentions, Kofi Annan and the UN in the Era of American World Power. Coming up, we remember the drama and literary critic Richard Gilman and listen back to the interview he recorded after the publication of his memoir, Faith, Sex, Mystery. Gilman died over the weekend. This is Fresh Air. Richard Gilman, the drama and literary critic, died over the weekend. He had been ill for several years after being diagnosed with terminal lung cancer in 1997. He was 83. Gilman grew up in New York and became a drama critic for Commonweal in the 50s and for Newsweek in the mid-60s. He was a professor at the Yale University School of Drama for 31 years. His students included the playwrights Christopher Durang and Wendy Wasserstein. I spoke with Gilman in 1987, after the publication of his memoir, Faith, Sex, Mystery. It was about a side of his life even many of his friends weren't aware of, his conversion from Judaism to atheism to Catholicism to what he called a total state of disbelief. He said he came into the church because of death and left it because of sex. After 8 years as a Catholic, he concluded the church held no place for him sexually or intellectually. But the issues that brought him into the church remained important to him. You were born into Judaism. When you became religious, how come you didn't become a religious Jew?
Well, as I say in the book, I had a perfunctory Jewish upbringing. You know, I went to Hebrew school when I was bar mitzvahed and went to synagogue on the holy days. My mother and father were, I would say, perfunctory, nominal Jews. My grandparents were quite religious. But I didn't grow up in a religious home at all, and I never really learned anything about Judaism as a religion. Essentially, what it was a, at the, one sense, a tribal reality. And I never was interested in it as a religious thing, and it slipped away from me very quickly once I was bar mitzvah and reached 14, 15, at which point I declared myself a very adamant atheist, which was partly a political stance, you know, at the time. But for the next 10 years or so, I investigated passionately every kind of system of belief. I was looking for something.
What did you find in Catholicism that you didn't find in other places?
Well, I found truth, what I considered to be truth. There is a very... Well, not so strange. Something has happened in questions of intellect and questions of value, well, probably for the last couple of hundred years, which is that the truth of a proposition or of an idea isn't the crucial thing. The relevance of it is. And I was convinced through a rather lengthy and arduous process of thought that Catholic claims to be the repository of truth in the very basic sense were justified. I joined the church essentially not for sentimental reasons, certainly not for emotional reasons, essentially for on the basis of the fact that once I saw something as true, it seemed to me that I had to act on it.
During the first part of your stay in the church as a converted Catholic, you were feeling a lot from it. When you were getting the most from it,
yes.
What was it you were getting?
Well, I was getting a sense of priority. I was getting a sense of being, well, I described it as being carried by updrafts of grace. Of being sustained by a reality beyond myself, greater than myself, you know, all those kinds of things. I felt that my will was supported. I could will effectively. I could act the way I thought I should act. It's the only period in my life, and this lasted several years, in which I felt that my whole being, my psychic, my intellectual, my emotional selves were cohesive and moving together, and that didn't last, but it was there for a while.
You felt that integrated, but were you able to tell your parents that you converted?
I never told my parents, and I explain again in the book why. My parents were not Orthodox Jews. They were not very religious Jews, but they were very psychologically Jewish. And I didn't have a good relationship with my father. But apart from that, I felt that there was no point in my telling them. They would not have understood. They would have felt offended. They would have felt affronted. They would have exploded or fainted or something. And I felt that there was not much point in telling them. I didn't believe then, and I don't believe now, in the primary virtue of what that fashionable word, sincerity. We should be sincere, you know. Sincerity hides a lot of spiritual pride. It hides a lot of arrogance and so on. I saw no reason for hurting them, and I saw no gain or value in that kind of sincerity in telling them. They suspected. They knew, especially when I started writing for a Catholic magazine called Jubilee, and then later Commonwealth.
A clue.
They must have had some. I told them that these magazines did employ some non-Catholic writers, but I think they were so happy that I finally had a job, because I had not had a job. I was drifting through my 20s as what I used to call an intellectual bum or hobo. And so they were so pleased that I finally had a job that I think they would have swallowed anything. But in any case, I didn't tell them.
We're listening back to an interview with the drama and literary critic Richard Gilman. He died over the weekend. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening back to a 1987 interview with the drama and literary critic Richard Gilman. He died over the weekend at the age of 83. I spoke with him after the publication of his memoir, Faith, Sex, Mystery. He converted from Judaism to Catholicism, but came to be frustrated by the church's view of sex.
I had trouble always reconciling the sexual aspects, the aspects of what are gathered under the rubric, the title lust, sins of the flesh, you know, lust. I think that obviously sexual sins are for many Catholics and much of the church as an institution, and for many religions, the most serious, the prime sin. And I don't think so. I've never thought so. I think that sexual sins can, for example, formal sexual sins, sins of lust, can have in them love, they can have in them generosity, they can have in them compassion and a sense of humanity, a sense of mortality and so on. In other words, they can have virtues in them that other sins like gluttony or avarice or cruelty, you know, do not have. And the church's emphasis, which is what I encountered, I think it has changed, I would imagine, certainly in the United States, changed for the better. It's not nearly as monolithic as it once was. The greatest trouble I had was what I thought of as the inflexibility, the abstract condemnation of certain acts which I felt needed to be seen in a more supple, a more complex way, and a more compassionate way.
We keep quoting St. Augustine as saying, God, send me chastity, but not yet.
Yes.
But I get the feeling that in your own life, you didn't want to have to totally sacrifice the flesh in order to find spirituality.
Exactly. I thought I should, in a way, not sacrifice it completely, but for example, I was married much of that time, and I had problems with my wife. I had, on an occasion, I would go outside marriage, and you know, in other words, commit what was be called technically, of course, adultery. I felt that my particular sexuality would be even more difficult for the church to accommodate. I remember thinking of Jesus sitting up on his throne in heaven and rolling his eyes in shock and horror at my particular fantasies, which, of course, is an absurd notion. But as I said before, I think no matter what my sexuality was, it would have come into conflict with the church. And that's the kind of response I've gotten from a lot of people who've written me, you know, about the book, that they experienced much of the same thing.
Well, I think for a lot of people who are religious or slightly religious, the conflict comes up between sexuality and religion, mm-hmm. or between some other belief or passion that they have in religion. And the question becomes, do you stay and fight off your impulses, or do you accept your impulses and leave the religious institution?
Yes, of course, that's the question. There was another aspect of my quarrel or battle with the church, and that was what I do call my ambition or my ambitiousness. When I came in the church, I felt a great relief from the burden of selfness, you know, burden of ambition, the burden of competitiveness, a feeling that I want to make a place for myself in the world. I was very ambitious, and I had for quite a time I was very content to sort of labor anonymously, not worry about making a name for myself. And then gradually, as I got into my 30s, and I had literary ambitions and had them, which I'd squelched, which I'd simply suppressed in myself. And I know it was a kind of foolish dichotomy that I or opposition that I erected there. I was taking the admonition to be humble and to efface myself quite literally. And even though I consciously knew and was told by people I knew at the time that there was nothing irreligious or sinful in developing my talents, you know, gaining a reputation, I felt guilty over that. And finally, the ambition, the suppressed literary desires broke through, and I began to feel that this humility that I'd had before was pretty false.
What do you even talk about? A self-aggrandizing kind of humility.
Yeah. Now, you see, I still think this is something that touches on a great many things. You pointed out at the beginning of the book, you quoted the idea that I do not have any real belief today. I still have some. I have a faint, more than faint, it's there. Some kind of, for example, I'm not an atheist. I believe in God. I don't know how or what. But one thing that I got from the church, from the essence of the church, the best part of the church, was a sense of something to combat the fierce, cannibalistic almost, you know, competitiveness of our time, which is gaining all the time, the aggression, the greed, the putting of the self first, which we phenomena we see all around us, you know, and it seems to grow all the time. I remember feeling that only through this kind of principle of at least partial self-effacement or generosity, a sense of giving to others, could you combat that, what seemed to be the tide of the times, you know, the tremendous individualism, the dog-eat-dog, the man is a wolf to man, and all of that, which I felt then and see even more strongly now.
So you believe in God in a kind of, but that's where the mystery comes in. It's not you're
yes.
not part of an organized religion
no.
right now.
No, I don't go to church. I don't know if I ever will go back. I didn't write the book in order to go back. You know, and yet I find stirrings of various kinds.
I want to ask you one mm-hmm. last thing. You almost apologize to your readers at the end of your memoir for giving them nothing definitive, no calls to order, no models for behavior, no moral resting place. But it seems to me that finally that's what your experience is about. It's about continually questing for some kind of answers to big questions, but not finding pat answers.
Right. Well, I think that came... I had the sense that and perhaps I was silly to worry about this, but I have a feeling that in books of this kind, the broad genre, people are looking for some kind of answer, and of course they get very cheap ones, you know, from lots of people. Some kind of thing. Now I'm this, and now I'm that, and by implication, this is what you should be, and this is what you might do, and so forth. I came out with no conclusion. I am still, as I said, peddling in midair. I don't. I have no answers. And it's interesting that a number of letters that I've gotten from people have told me that that's fine, it's all right, they didn't want me to, you know, that it would have been false if I'd come out with some denouement, you know, some final conclusion and saying, this is it, this is the truth. I don't know.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for sharing some of your experiences with us today. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Theater and literary critic Richard Gilman recorded in 1987 after the publication of his memoir, Faith, Sex, Mystery. He died over the weekend at the age of 83. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sharrock. Our engineer today is Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's complete Sherlock Holmes, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Cato Charitable Foundation, advancing environmental values and saluting all those who work to sustain our world. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we examine some of the potential problems in voting and counting the vote next Tuesday. We talk with Dan Seligson, editor of electionline.org, a nonpartisan organization that tracks and analyzes election reform issues, and the NAACP's Marvin Doc Cheatham and Reverend Nelson B. Rivers III. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.